Good evening. I'm Terry Thornton. I'm curator of education, and it's my great pleasure to welcome you to Tuesday Evenings at the Modern, which is an ongoing lecture series I think many of you are familiar with, but I invite you to visit the website if you don't know our schedule. We go through November 19th this year, and we have three more really outstanding lectures, so I invite you to check those out. And if you would, I'm going to ask you now for everybody to turn off their phones, their ringers. Thank you. Tonight we have artist Melanie Smith here from her home in Mexico City. I hope you've all had an opportunity to spend time with Melanie's captivating videos and the gorgeous paintings in the Modern's current exhibition, Mexico Inside Out, Themes in Art Since 1990. Clearly, curator Andrea Carnes was drawn to Melanie's work, recognizing its strength and potential within the context of this exhibition, as Andrea chose no less than four of her works and placed them throughout the exhibition with Spiral City, welcoming and engaging visitors in its prominent position at the top of the grand stairs, kind of introducing you to the exhibition. While Melanie was born in Poole, England, and received her Bachelor of Arts from the University of Reading, she has lived and worked in Mexico City since 1989. In an interview with the Modern's assistant curator, Allison Hurst, for the exhibition catalog, Melanie, whose work considers and addresses place, explained her relationship with her newfound home and its influence in her own development as an artist by stating, "It is all these little, hazy, fractured zones and unknowns that we live in here in Mexico that interest me. I see how people live in Europe. I don't know if I'm necessarily interested in that way of living. I think these pockets of ambiguity in Mexico City create potentialities." This is all something that I think we can see in Melanie's work. And given the strength of her ideas, her curiosity, her clear-eyed investigation and attachment to the place, it was no surprise that Melanie was chosen in 2011 to represent Mexico with red square and possible pink for the 54th Venice Biennale. Her exhibition record is extensive, having shown at significant institutions nationally and internationally, including PS1 and MoMA in New York, UCLA Hamra Museum in L.A., ICA Boston, Tate Liverpool, Tate Modern, and South London Gallery in London, Lima Art Museum, El Eco Experimental Museum, and the Tamayo Contemporary Art Museum in Mexico City, as well as the Monterey Museum in Monterey, Mexico. A retrospective of Melanie's work, Spiral City and Other Artificial Pleasures, traveled from the University Museum of Science and the Arts in Mexico City to the lab in Denver, Colorado, and closing at MIT List in Boston in 2009. She has produced three artist books, Spiral City and Other Artificial Pleasures in 2006, Pere in 2008, Red Square and Possible Pink in 2011, Short Circuit in 2012, and Chilitla, I can't say that, help me, Chilitla. She'll re-say it, so we'll get it when she gets up here. In 2012. Tonight, Melanie is here to present Melanie Smith, Skewed Vision, In and Out of Mexico. So without further delay, please join me in giving her a warm, warm welcome.
Well, thank you, Terry, and thank you very much to Andrea for inviting me and her team here at the Modern. It's really nice to be here, nice to be here and have the opportunity to share some of my thoughts and works with you, and a little bit of the background of how I conceive and make my work. I think my work is a very layered and complex work, and there are many aspects which it could be focused on, such as color, the urban situation, the absent body, in and out of painting, abstraction, and my relationship as a subject in relation to the colonial and modernity. Tonight I'm going to talk about my relationship, or slightly difficult relationship, to painting the canvas and the rectangle. The rectangle is an ongoing preoccupation in my work. And this often translates itself from, let's say, the canvas, the physical, the physicality of the canvas and painting itself, and how then the canvas might get broken or ruptured in the geopolitical sense, the breaking of the rectangle, the breaking of frontiers and territories, and how that gets reverted and subverted in my vision as a subject, as an English artist who lives in Mexico, whose formation was in England, but whose work is very much informed by the tradition of minimalism, and how that has got shifted and ruptured in the very chaotic Baroque life in and out of Mexico City. So I will start with a piece of work which was probably from 98. It's a sort of starting point and a finishing point, because this is where I am right now. I am currently working on a project in the Amazon. So I think it's kind of an appropriate image to start with, because, as I say, this is where I'm finishing as well. But I was somehow informed as a painter, but never really a painter in my own right. I have this sort of constant frustration with painting. I like painting, but at the same time, I'm always sort of almost I can't be one of those people that sits and confronts the white wall for hours on end and on their own. I kind of need always that sort of feedback from other people. But this, I think, this work shows this sort of first attempts at almost, you know, the confinement of the rectangle. These are all elements. This is called Green Lush, and they're all elements that are plastic, stuck on a kind of on a board. And I think here there's this, you can see this already, this kind of antagonism, where there's almost this kind of bursting out of the rectangle that, you know, I'm contained there in the rectangle, but all these elements at the same time want to burst out. They're all found in Mexico City, in the area where I lived when I was when I first arrived there. This also is another work from that time, Orange Lush, very much thinking in the line of Ligia Clark and these sort of bodily appendages which she worked with, almost like these sort of healing objects that she worked with, but almost translating that sense of these sort of synthetic organs, if you like, all in the color orange. I think they all had a kind of bodily feeling, all collected within this same area in the downtown of Mexico City where I lived. And again, still in a sense, compositions, painterly compositions in their own right, but all just lightly going off that edge. All, you know, like the, this small edge that you can see just right here. They're all just, you know, just coming off, not quite content to be, you know, confined within that rectangle. This was another series of, a slide series from the same series of Orange Lush, where I went out in Mexico City and took these sort of archaeological artifacts, all of the color orange, and the metro, the plastic plates. It was almost like it was my orange world. This series is called My World. I was thinking very much about the artificial orange, not the natural orange. This was the artificial chemical orange that was always, or in Mexico City at least, is always at the corner of your eye. This was the orange that to sell. This was the orange that was about that almost this synthetic world, and in a sense I was homogenizing my vision of these artifacts through the use of this one color. Having done all these sort of, in a sense, archaeological research of synthetic culture on the ground in Mexico City, I then, probably as a good foreigner, had this need to remove myself from that situation on the ground. I think it was quite a sort of an intuitive need, in a sense, to make some sense in a sort of macro level of the things that I'd been working with on a micro level. In a micro level, what I'd been working on in a macro level. So it occurred to me to get a helicopter. This was in 2002. And circle the city in an area on the southeast side of the airport, Ixtapalapa, which is one of the many lower class satellite areas of the city. And I chose this area because of its low density of greens, and also for its lack of monuments. Although it still is structured in the grid sense. But when you see the video, which perhaps some of you have already seen outside here, it's quite evident that this is not a European city, precisely for its lack of monuments. There's no real huge buildings that stick out at you or are really prominent. And on the first trip, I made two trips in a helicopter, and on the first trip, I was just going backwards and forwards in the helicopter, not thinking that perhaps these going backwards and forwards would produce something interesting in image terms. When I saw the material, I realized that the material was totally wrong, that I couldn't make any real sense of this linear sort of approach to how I had been filming. And it was at that moment when one of those 3 o'clock in the morning, I guess, moments between consciousness and unconsciousness, when it suddenly clicked to me that seeing the city from above was very much like seeing these crystalline, eroded structures, much like Robert Smithson's spiral jetty. So this inspired a second trip where I did a spiral movement in the helicopter, going from low down to higher up, and it just seemed to suddenly click with me that this groundlessness, or again this breaking of the grid and this constant destabilizing of the grid, was something which that I was interested in capturing. As some of you may have already heard in the galleries, there's a sort of very eerie sound, hollow wind sound to this video, which brings a sort of, I think, a certain almost apocalyptic feeling where you're drawn to the past. It's almost like a future past, I think. You know, that there's a sense that as it's in black and white, this is a document of the present, of the moment. But at the same time, there's this haunting sense of what is to come and what is the future. And then out of this series, I did a series of maybe 30 paintings. Actually, sorry, this is slightly the wrong way around, because these were the first... These paintings were the first paintings in that series. They're made with airbrush, and they're very... These first ones are very layered, done with plantilla, something of the word, where cut out rectangles again. But the paintings themselves have this almost fuzzy kind of feeling to them, that the closer you get, the less you see, and the further back you get, the more you see. A kind of the sensation which I think is very symptomatic of oneself as a subject in the metropolis, that the further you go in, the less you know, and the further you're out, the more you might see, certainly as a foreigner. So yes, these were the rectangles were the first ones, and then these vanishing landscapes appeared subsequently. I think in general that now that I can see my work with perhaps over 20, 25 years of practice, I can see with hindsight now that there is been this sort of constant and conscious search for the relationship between the urban situation and nature. Even if I look back on those early Orange Lush works now, I think of them almost like as if those were sort of tropical or sort of artificial fruits of the jungle, or even Green Lush itself is almost like an artificial fruits of the concrete jungle. And I think as my practice has grown, there's this ever-growing sort of tangent between the urban and extra-urban situation. And this next series of work, which is called Pares, is another sort of tussle somehow with my own history and this extra-urban situation. This is a small town which is on the outside of Mexico City, where I did a series, it's a trilogy. And this trilogy somehow renegotiates the monochrome. The monochrome for me has always been this sort of somehow a framing, or the way in which at least monochromatic painting is or could be perceived as some kind of window onto spirituality, onto nature, onto contemplation. And somehow in this series, what I was thinking about was how could the monochrome be renegotiated in the context of Latin America? Well, how could that reversal of the window or the frame be contemplated? So, and this is a 3-minute video, a film piece actually, where you know the character walks up to the screen. And then at one point the spectator realizes that there is a glass in front of the camera, and he starts painting the screen, and then the last image is where the screen is totally covered. So here we are really thinking about this renegotiation of the gaze. What happens here, where this sort of utopian moment gets turned into a dystopian moment, where the gaze is somehow reverted, where we are no longer thinking about contemplation and the invitation of the frame and the looking in, but we're thinking about the gaze and how, as a spectator, we are blinded by a certain gaze. And this was the second in that trilogy where, obviously this is me, where the camera moves away from myself as a figure, this sort of English figure left in the rain here, and at the end of the video, the rain, it's actually made by a rain machine, the rain machine just completely covers the screen, again forming a monochrome. So in this second piece, it's actually more about me as a subject and how I'm inserted into that landscape. And the third one is actually where this smudgy, it's almost the reverse of the first parrot, where the this man is uncovering the screen, but it's left as this smudgy kind of resonance where the view or the gaze is unclear. And then, just to quickly say that I did a series of paintings which were related to this Paris series, where I actually did the paintings and then physically blocked the paintings, the access to the paintings, with walls. So the viewer, you had to kind of get into this really uncomfortable 40-50 centimeter sort of cubby hole at the back to be able to see these paintings. Again, this reversal of the gaze, where minimalism was in a sense blocking this kind of grim reality of the painting that was behind, and where the spectator's eye was always skewed. There was no frontal access to these paintings, so you always had to be seeing them from the side. Another sort of subset of this series, where I became more interested in what was going on around the paintings, where the process of sometimes in my studio when I was making these paintings, sometimes I get more interested in what was going on, the mark making around the paintings than the paintings themselves. So this was a show where the Paris videos were shown inside this black, where the black door is, and these empty frames were and walls were shown on the outside. This is another example of one of the hidden paintings. So this ever-growing extra urban sort of search took me to a place called Xilitla, which some of you may have heard of. Xilitla is a surrealist set of, I hate to call it, I cannot call it sculpture garden because I think it doesn't really do it justice because it's certainly not a sculpture garden. It's a surrealist garden made by the English patron of the arts called Edward James, who went to Mexico in the 1940s. Edward James himself was a very rich man, rumored to be the son of Edward VII. He was obviously brought up in extreme wealth, and he was a collector himself of Dada and surrealist paintings. And when he came, he fell in love with Mexico, also fell in love himself, but also fell in love with Mexico. And over the year, he found this place, which is by a huge waterfall, 10 hours from Mexico City, going through the Sierra Gorda in the jungle. Very humid place. And over the course of 20 years, he started making these structures out of cement. He used the whole town, virtually, in making these structures. They're made with molds, and they're unfinished, folly-like structures. Here's one of them, which is painted blue. His idea of these structures, let me see if I can, find a better... here's one of them on the right-hand side, where there are these sort of columns and stairs which lead to nowhere, structures which go up and down. Here's another one of them, which is, you know, three or four layers of open rooms and arches, very much influenced by surrealism and the Gothic. There's an awful lot of sort of verticality in the place itself. And his idea was that these structures would exist and that over the years nature would reclaim these structures and that they would grow over them and they would sort of dissolve entropically back into the landscape. So I was for years have been very intrigued by this place, partly because of being English myself, partly because of wanting to make some kind of comment about what this site could mean in a contemporary sense. I was very much interested in the entropic nature of the place. I was interested in surrealism. I was interested in the urban, the extra-urban, and nature itself. So this was were the things that really drew me to this place. But at the same time, I realized I didn't want to do a documentary about the place. I was very much aware of layering and putting my own thoughts and sentiments as an artist. So perhaps if we could, John, put on the video. It's a 10-minute piece. Then I can talk a little bit about it after. Should I carry on, and then if we have time, we'll come back to it? Okay, great. Yeah. Okay. Perhaps then could we go on to the next slides? Let me think where I was. Okay. So, as you can see, or nearly could see, the format of the film is vertical. I was thinking a lot of the place, about the place itself, and how, in a sense, it goes against the rationale of the idea of building in architecture. In a sense that with his idea that these buildings would be made in order to fall down, seems to me to go against this sort of functionalist idea of architecture. And so the irrational sense of the place, I wanted to somehow reproduce that in the format itself, and the format itself of putting something vertical, where the verticality of the horizontality of cinema is always the horizontal frame. I was thinking of how this verticality could also go against the sort of rationale of cinema itself. So it was quite a difficult feat to film vertically, and it's been quite a challenge always to be projecting vertically. But the place itself is quite vertical and also extremely green. But one of the features that I was thinking about was not making it green, because everybody that goes to Hilitla automatically makes Hilitla green. So a lot of the film is shot in this very blue, almost ominous light. There we go. Okay. So this is how it should be seen. This is how the piece was installed in the Venice Biennale in 2011. Very much thinking of how the ruin of Hilitla could be translated or paralleled in some way to the ruin of Venice, is that sort of sinking entropic sensation or all-consuming sensation that there is in Venice. How could that be paralleled in Hilitla? I'm not sure if there's a... Oh, yeah, this is... It's a shame. I can't show you because this is one of the central characters in the film. Lucio is one of the gardeners at Hilitla now, and he has a lazy eye. And I was thinking a lot of how that his lazy eye would go back to Smith's, or retrace somehow Robert Smithson's work in the Yucatan, in his mirror displacement series, where the mirror displacement was also retracing the steps of 19th century travelers Stevens and sorry, I've completely forgotten his name. The Stevens and the Catherwood, the illustrator. Anyway, what was Robert Smithson was thinking about in the mirror displacement pieces was very much that way in which the mirror or the camera never reflects back in the Renaissance, like a sense of reflecting back an ever-vanishing one-point perspective. He was thinking about how these mirrors also reflected back this sort of skewed vision. And I wanted to also reflect in through Lucio, the gardener's eye, this skewed vision of the world, and James's skewed vision of the world, of why would somebody be going to this lost place in the middle of the jungle to make these eccentric, folly-like structures which nobody would see and that nobody would really care about. They were only for himself, as he was the public. No one else was allowed in there. So... again, that made me think of myself as a subject and my skewed vision as a subject of this foreigner who was making comments on another foreigner's works, and how this whole idea of, in a sense, that idyllic, James's vision of the idyllic English garden was translated into this exotic place in Hilitla. So I'm constantly reverting the gaze, I think, in this project. And this was a series of paintings, again, which I did in tandem with the Hilitla series. Not that there actually are monkeys there, but... And these were shown, in again, with Hilitla in the Venice Biennale, in this place where previous paintings had been hung. And I'll just show it so you can see them here. You can just see the kind of the marks where other paintings had been hung. So it was, again, this sort of shifting off the rectangle where... but there was the same sense of sort of mimesis of how these sort of tropical paintings were being placed in the decadence of the European context. Quickly to talk a little bit about the Aztec Stadium piece, which is shown here. This was a piece done in 2010 in the context of the bicentenary celebrations in Mexico. Again, at the height of the drugs war, and that many people were questioning if there really was anything to be celebrating in Mexico at that time. I was not really commissioned, but asked to work with the Fundación Televisa, who own the Aztec Stadium. It was a kind of collaboration piece, the Aztec Stadium. These are some pictures of the building of the Aztec Stadium, which was made by the Mexican architect Pedro Ramírez Vázquez, who made a lot of the iconic stadiums, museums, public buildings in Mexico between the 50s and the present day. Well, not present day now, because he's died. But so I was very drawn to that sense of how this building the power representation implicit in this building. And also, again, my initial thought about when I'd been making this project was, which I made in collaboration with Rafael Ortega, by the way, we were both thinking very much, we had in our heads the initial image was, I'll just put it on here. Let's flip back. Malevich's Red Square was the sort of first impulse for this project. Thinking of how we could position Malevich's Red Square in Mexico, what Malevich's Red Square might mean in the context and questioning of painting itself, what would it mean by trying to recreate Malevich's Red Square with people and flashcards, and itself, how this painting has very much been, or very much is, this sort of representation of that iconic moment between representation and abstraction, and that utopian moment in the suprematist movement and the constructivist moment. So this was very much, or always been, the sort of anchor in the project, that how could that Red Square somehow be broken up, and how could we think about that utopian moment versus this dystopian moment through which we were living in 2010 in Mexico. So, going back a little bit, these are the... that was, as I say, the basis for the project. And then... thinking about how that the Malevich's Red Square could form some kind of access with images, iconic images from Mexican history, such as the La Patria, which is the image on all textbook school textbooks to the day, and how that became disintegrated in the action. Xepetotec, the mask of appearance, the Aztec mask of appearance, and how that was broken up, and how that was, I can see it, but sorry, but further here, you can just see it on the right, how that was paired with the Santo, the mask, playing of these ideas of appearance and disappearance, that oscillation of the image, how the image kind of came about through the action of the children. And Bribiesca's Angel of Independence, the Angel of Independence. So I was causing, in a sense, these sort of anachronisms. Everything was playing against everything. There was also a transparent placard that was used. And it created at least the day of the performance, where there was only one chance given for these 3,000 students to come along and perform these acts, and they really didn't like doing it. They were very rebellious. They didn't want to do it. There were moments when the image appeared. There were moments when the image disappeared. So we thought that we very much had to play with that moment of accident and that moment where we weren't doing a Korean-style coordinated kind of action. And the accident, as I said, very much became part of the piece, where I was constantly thinking about the individual and the mass, the idea of revolution, chaos, how that moment, that very turgid moment when everything is chaotic, can be the moment for potentialities to start happening in those very sort of turgid friction like moments. And then at the end, I think the most telling moment for me, and one of the questions which I'm still left with as an artist, is what happened at that moment of breaking up of this rectangle? What happens when that moment, that painting moment, gets turned into an action? What happens when that ordered moment, that disciplined moment, turns into chaos, and that oscillation between appearance and disappearance? How can these moments, or aesthetic moments, perhaps be turned into geopolitical moments? I guess, as I say, that was one of the driving forces, but still behind a lot of my work, is that how the aesthetic frame relates to that rupture in the geopolitical frame. Sorry, that was an image that wasn't supposed to be there, but this clay also was Paul Klee's Angel. Also was, excuse me, a second moment, where he was also on the, I'm not sure if it's here, but he was also on that big screen there. This image of Paul Klee's was the gaze of the angel was also always looking upon this action that was being carried out throughout the whole day. So it was also this sort of citation to Walter Benjamin's interpretation of Paul Klee's angel, and how that there was this sort of, the angel was constantly gazing onto this imminent disaster and chaos that was that was certainly present throughout our day. So I just want to talk. Sorry, there he is. I knew it was there somewhere. Just briefly to talk about my current project. This is a place called Fordlandia, which is in the middle of the Amazon, in the River Tapajós. It's about 12 hours from Santarém by boat. It's a small settlement today, but it was the site where Henry Ford in the 1920s set up, which some of you probably might know, was set up a rubber industry. Planted many trees in the area over 20-30 year period. Another of these failed utopian projects, in the sense that he invested millions and millions of dollars in this plantation and in this industry. I think basically after many years of resistance to the landscape, nature itself, realized that it wasn't a good place to be growing the rubber trees. There was basically, I think what he tried to do was take an American workforce down there. He took American houses and he took American machinery to, and never went himself, by the way, and to create this as I say it, industry. And even having been there myself, now I realize that it's probably why I have this voice like I have today, because I just got back. It's 40 degrees. It's impossible to work. It's humid. It's hot. There are many mosquitoes. The malaria was rife at the time, so it killed a lot of people off. And he was trying to, or the managerial group was trying to grow trees in straight lines. And these trees, the rubber trees, can't grow in lines because they catch viruses if they're grown too closely together. So they need this kind of organic chaos to thrive. I was, again, very struck by another one of these utopian projects, thinking very much in the lines of the ruin. My focus... here's another one of the shots of the water tower there. My focus has, again, been a kind of rereading of that expansion... colonialist sort of expansionism, and how I've been focusing a lot on the machinery. This is the place itself, the site where most of the work took place, which is again itself is a ruin. Thinking of this sort of idea of the machine. And in a sense, have I got some other pictures? Sorry, I just go back forward one. Here. Thinking of this, the way in which the machines there are out of use. Thinking of that, the idea of the, in a sense, the death of the machine, that utopian moment has passed, how this, the decadence of this ruin versus the potentiality of nature. So a lot of my focus has been on how nature and animal life somehow, through animals that really never think of any conception beyond their own immediacy and beyond their own sense of the moment, animals that never think about tomorrow, and how I can make some kind of parallel between that, the machine progress, linearity, the ruin, modernity, and the animal as this vibrancy, as this potentiality, as this moment of living for that moment or that that sort of life itself, really. So a lot of my focus has been going after eyes of crocodiles, eyes of jaguars, the fur, the close-ups of details of movements of animals, and paralleling it with this black and white images of very much the sort of still moment of the buildings versus this camera moment. Free camera moment where these animals are being taken in detail and focused on. So I'm trying to somehow, you know, work on two levels of material here, where there is a sort of document and the still moment, and then the vibrancy and the live moment. So I guess I'll stop there for the moment. Perhaps thinking about the first image of Green Lush, and then how I've gone full circle to this, again, to this middle of nowhere, but still in search of these sort of extra urban places, and that fight, I suppose, with how nature still, for me at least, could form some kind of resistance. So thank you very much. So do we...
Do you want to take questions?
Well, I don't know if anybody has any questions. No. It's all very clear.
Yeah, I'm really sorry about the video. I think that you did a nice job of explaining the verticality versus the synastry, and I was really taken by the fact that we're sitting here looking at this very horizontal screen with your... John, I take it that's a no-go?
It looks like I need to restart my computer, so I'd be glad to do that while you're taking questions.
Okay, that seems to be a question.
So for the film, how did you achieve that vertical effect? Did you simply turn the camera?
Yeah, it was.
The film that way, or?
It's shot on 2x35mm, but we made a special adaptation for the camera so that it was filmed. And, you know, it was like a sort of L-shaped adaptation that was made on the tripod and the camera, so it was physically filmed like that as well.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious what your intention is behind using painting versus film or video, different points, even in this exhibition, the cityscapes between the video piece and the paintings, and like, what does each medium offer to you?
I think it's a very good question, because right now I'm thinking a lot about can I say now what I've been saying in painting? Can I say it now in video and without the need to paint? I think there's, for me, it's always still that, the painting, I guess, goes back to this, the idea of the animal and the life, that somehow painting is still very much that immediate, that sort of life process, and meditated, if you want. And I guess that, especially in the later paintings, what I'm looking for a lot is this sort of the same turgid space that a lot of the newer paintings, particularly, are quite layered and worked on. They're kind of painted up, if you want, and then shaven away, or for me, right now, at least when a painting is working, It has, it's suspended somehow. So I'm, in a sense, I'm looking for that suspended moment in painting as I am, and that suspended moment, the Malevich moment, when there is that dissolution, in a sense, and there is no answer. I think in my practice, in general, the way in which I work with video and with paintings, I'm not looking necessarily for any answers about the way I set up my videos. And it is a shame that we can't see the Hilitla piece, and although I think it can be seen in the Aztec Stadium, is that there's almost this setting up expectation in the moment that expectation in video seems to be fulfilled, I cut. So I'm constantly working with a kind of expectation that is never fulfilled. And I think that somehow in painting I'm trying to do the same thing. And I don't know how successful it is, but and as I say, I do ask myself a lot, like, could I just cut the paintings and just say it with one thing? But there is, again, it comes, draws me back to another practice, that there's that, it's a sort of alone practice in the studio, which I don't get from video work. So and there, it's still, for me at least, extremely hard to be confronted with that rectangle. So I guess that's what always keeps me drawn back there, you know?
Can you say something about
the steps?
Oh, yeah.
Can you say something, kind of to follow along with that question, about how artist books fit within the equation for you, or how they may allow something in addition to this relationship between painting and video, or not, perhaps they don't, and how they fit within the equation?
Hmm. Wait, you're thinking of the Hilitla book? Or?
The books that she mentioned earlier.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, again, it's, I'm always learning things with books. As I keep showing, and as I keep developing as an artist, I'm ever more conscious of how paintings must be placed with videos. It's at least in my work, it's problematic, and I think in books, in publications, somehow these paintings, I think what I'm always trying to do is sort of, as I'm, I think this video of Hilitla shows, is I'm always trying to dismantle the gaze, the colonial gaze and the subjective gaze. So I think in terms of books, that for me is an opportunity to place paintings alongside very surprising video images, for example. I mean, for me, that it's an opportunity where one would be forced to read painting in a, let's say, in a different way. So I'm interested in doing artist books. It's a challenge, but I... you know, as I think my work is all about dismantling. In a funny way, it's all about collage. You know, how these different layers get shoved together in anachronisms and pushed apart. So I always welcome that with book work. Yeah, I think it's a great opportunity for those two things to come apart and come together.
Working. yeah, I've got that video working if you want to watch it.
Ooh, let's see it. Finally get to the moment.
Is this the first take? And
6 a.m. morning, recording groups. That's okay if you have another room.
Things aren't part of it.
vamos a ver la segunda toma en este lunes en la mañana con el Rodanik.
Vamos a grabar con la escoba sobre azulejos. Esta vez lo va a grabar.
Y ahorita tenemos otra versión de votos encima, otro tipo de hoja.
Este es un segundo intento con más amplio el volumen. Aquí. Tercera versión.
Oh. Finally got there. It's good to be able to see it. White moments were meant to be, but not the black. Yeah. We kind of got better after. I mean, I think that's what I think about, really was thinking about how I'm constantly trying to set up the moment and then collapse the moment. And I guess that's constantly how I'm thinking about the colonial gaze, is somehow dismantling the colonial gaze, where I'm no longer looking for the exotic moment, but I'm looking to dismantle that exotic moment, and somehow myself being a subject that, I guess, as this, you know, the subject of this talk is this being somebody that is lives in Mexico, but not coming or not being born in Mexico, but constantly being aware of how we can no longer think about this idea of periphery and center, and somehow how, for me at least now, where modernity has come from and where we are, that it is one big modernity, and everything is one big hybrid sort of melting pot. So constantly these gazes get messed up and set up and then crash and then collapse. And I think that my work is, in a sense, that's you know, where a lot of it is about. It's not defining any of these one particular gazes anymore. So I guess I'll leave it there. Mm-hmm.